It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Census Bureau takes an official count of the population every 10 years. And what may seem like a simple headcount is actually a major undertaking.
The Wisconsin author of a new book on the census says it requires years of preparation, especially now in the middle of the decade, and getting an accurate count has high stakes.
The census determines how many congressional seats each state gets, along with the allocation of trillions of federal dollars for programs like Medicaid and Head Start.
But the Census Bureau is in flux under the Trump administration with growing concerns that the 2030 count could run into trouble.
Philip Rocco is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. His new book is called Counting Like a State, How Intergovernmental Partnerships Shaped the 2020 U.S. Census. Phil, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good to be with you, Kate.
You include a quote from a Greek economist early on that says, statistics is a combat sport. How does that apply to the U.S. Census?
So if you think about the census, it is the primary way that we get the information that we use to allocate seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Electoral College, do redistricting at the state level, and allocate trillions of dollars in federal and state aid around the country. So the census allocates political power around the country. It also allocates a significant amount of resources, and thus it is not a stranger to political conflict because of the stakes, the political power stakes involved in decisions about how we count people, who gets counted, and what we try to do to correct for the fact that on a fairly routine basis, numerous Americans are undercounted or systematically missed from the census. So the point is that politics, because the census shapes the allocation of power and resources, politics really enters into the way that we count ourselves in a kind of profound way.
And indeed, you dedicate the book to the uncounted. Who does the census miss?
So historically, the census has undercounted people of color, Hispanic Americans, often in many censuses, Asian Americans, people in the Native American community, as well as people who are lower income, people who are renters, as opposed to owning a house. There are a lot of populations that are systematically undercounted by the census. And while the undercount has generally speaking gotten better decade after decade, 2020 was sort of a reversion of that trend. It was the highest undercount for a number of those populations since 1990.
You also called 2020 a perfect storm. What made the 2020 census so difficult?
Take your pick. So this is the thing, is that I started writing this book years before the pandemic hit. And already people were talking about the census in 2020 as a perfect storm. I'll give you a few examples. So first, you had a pattern of congressional underfunding for key census operations, which meant that especially as new technologies were being brought online, it was more difficult for the Bureau to kind of pilot test some of those technologies. Additionally, prior to the pandemic, people might not remember, there was a very tight labor market, which means that it was harder to hire census enumerators than it had been in past decades. The 2010 census took place during the Great Recession, so a lot easier to hire enumerators, people to go and count and so forth in that census. Additionally, you had several initiatives by the Trump administration to essentially engineer an undercount of communities with large numbers of undocumented immigrants by introducing, for the first time, a citizenship question on the census questionnaire. And as was later revealed through public records requests, a very deliberate effort on the part of a Republican strategist named Tom Hoefler to shift power in the House of Representatives towards, in his words, quote, Republicans and non-Hispanic whites. So Even before the pandemic, there were a number of operational and political challenges that made this 2020 census really, really difficult to conduct.
But from the outside looking in, we might think of the census as just this really straightforward, simple head count. Why is it way more complex than that?
The census is one of the most difficult projects that the federal government conducts. And one of the main reasons why is that convincing people that they should voluntarily fill out a census form on their own and return it to the federal government, especially in a climate where there's a lot of distrust of the government and where the purposes of the census, this thing that happens once every 10 years, when you compare it to other events in politics, you know, elections are every 2 or 4 or 6 years, it can be very difficult to persuade people, even if they trust that their data are going to be kept confidential and private, that there is some return in the end for them taking the time out of their day and providing that form. And if you think about the composition of the United States population, it's growing, it's changing where it is, the residential housing stock, where you would want to reach people to count them, is morphing as cities grow, as there's an oil boom in North Dakota, you get new colonies of mobile homes for the workers there. It's just a very dynamic population, and a population whose relationship to the federal government isn't one where there's necessarily going to be a lot of trust. And so this thing that would seem really simple to do conceptually or on paper is, historically speaking, one of the hardest things that we do.
As you talk about trust, it reminds me that you spend time in your book talking about how states are really relying on these trusted messengers then to go out, fan out, to educate and really activate the hardest to count populations to fill out the census. Can you talk more about how states have done that and where states fall short?
Yeah, so I'll just begin by saying for decades, the Census Bureau, really when they started doing what's known as the self-enumeration census or mail response, in other words, on the first instance, you're sent a form or an invitation to fill the census out online now and return it, the Census Bureau has known that it's really important to reach people, not just through advertising, through commercials, through billboards and so forth, but through networks of trust. In other words, relying on officials and community leaders who people already know to receive messages from those people about why it's important and safe to fill out your census. The reality is, as important as those outreach campaigns have been, it is not the case that all of the states and cities where undercounts are going to be really likely did the same level of investments.
And you found Wisconsin invested $0 for the 2020 census, whereas our neighbor Illinois invests over $30 million. New York City, you point out, spending roughly $40 million on census outreach. So why was there this disparity in support between states?
Well, there's four basic things that I talk about in the book that help explain kind of why you see these different levels of investment. So first, for states and cities and other units of government, the census is not in fact their responsibility. Even though they are affected by the census, they are not, so to speak, legally on the hook for that outreach. So if they don't do it or it's underinvested in, the sense that there's going to be attribution of blame is somewhat more muted. Second, not every state, city, county is at the same risk of being undercounted. As a state, Wisconsin's response rate to the census is actually fairly good, although there are pockets in the state where historically undercounted populations are far more numerous. Cities like Milwaukee would be one example, as well as some tribal areas in the state where the undercount is a bit higher. And so there can be differential incentives, I guess you would say, for states with different sizes of undercounted population. But additionally, there is a partisan political tenor to these investment decisions. In some states, the politics of investing in the census were just kind of politically poisoned by the Trump administration's efforts to put a citizenship question on the census. And I have interviews with folks who are working for Republican governors, and they're saying, look, the governor understands that it's really, really important to invest in the census, but they're worried about being primaried, and thus even mentioning the census is sort of politically off limits. And then in states like Wisconsin, the census funding for outreach kind of got caught up in a pretty predictable budget battle between a Democratic governor and a Republican state legislature. So that's just sort of normal politics of a divided government can affect it as well. And then finally, there are states, cities and counties where the level of resources that those governments have to expend on the census are very, very small. And especially when you have a number of programs that it's sort of mandatory to fund, the census can be seen by elected officials as a nice to have rather than a must have, even if, and this is really important, even if there's going to be a huge effect on federal funding or even representation from an undercount. The state of Florida is kind of an interesting example. I think the state in 2020 was undercounted by about 750,000 people. And there have been calculations that over a decade, that might mean anywhere from $11 to $21 billion in losses in federal aid.
Wow. We're talking with political scientist Philip Rocco from Marquette University. The new book about the 2020 census, it's called Counting Like a State. Philip, let's look closer to home, the situation with Whitewater. Communities that are undercounted, you mentioned a lot is on the line here. Can you talk more about the recounts, what the count question resolution program is, and how did it change the situation for Whitewater after the 2020 census?
Yeah, so I want to emphasize that the census doesn't really allow for recounts as we might think. If you are just because your city might have been undercounted or your state might have been undercounted, the census's hands are kind of tied in responding to that. But if there are errors in where certain pockets of your population were assigned geographically in the census file, it is possible through a program called Count Question Resolution to issue a challenge and then to have a population correctly located. And often this happens with populations in college towns or in places where there are incarceration facilities. But the reality is that process has very tight regulations on what kinds of challenges can be brought forward. And I want to emphasize that just because you think your city was undercounted, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to prevail in a count question resolution in challenge. And so, I mean, one of the big takeaways, I think, from the book is that it's really, really, really important that the census kind of gets it right the first time, because once the census is done, the opportunities that you have for making corrections are fairly limited.
You talk about how ahead of the 2030 census, or any census for that matter, it's the middle years that really determine the quality of the census and those investments in the middle of the decade, which is now. You know, like the design and the testing of the questionnaires and preparing address lists and the outreach plans. How is this looking now for the next census count in 2030?
I think census advocates are in general fairly concerned about the quality of the 2030 census for a variety of reasons. I think on the one hand, you have the Trump administration. There's been some signals that they will try to reintroduce a citizenship question on the 2030 questionnaire, and frankly, whether or not they do. They have taken some steps, including in recent weeks in Los Angeles and other cities, to kind of create a climate of distrust that might have kind of the same effect on the census environment and the incentives of people to respond to the 2030 count. And so that's pretty worrisome. Additionally, in the early months of the Trump administration, there's been eliminations of 1,000 full-time equivalent employees at the Census Bureau. The administration has disbanded several important advisory committees, including a scientific advisory committee for the Census Bureau, which is really important in ensuring that the Bureau is using kind of the latest techniques and that it's meeting its operational milestones. That kind of oversight is really important. And then additionally, there are some real questions about the adequacy of congressional funding for the 2030 census and whether or not the funding is going to be adequate for piloting some of the key operations that'll be necessary to for the census to be ready operationally in time for 2030. So there are, and in many ways, similar to the last decade, some real concerns about whether or not we're doing what we need to do right now to ensure that the 2030 census is as best as it can be.
So, Phil, as we close, what is your advice to states like Wisconsin as we move closer to this next census? What should states do?
Well, I would say a few things. So first, for both states and, you know, if not states, then certainly cities and counties where there are high pockets of historically undercounted people, and you can look at data sources on the 2020 census to see some examples of that, there is a real value to investing in census outreach. Even if there is a 1% undercount of the Wisconsin population, it means hundreds of millions of dollars in lost federal aid for programs like Medicaid. So there's a real value in investing in that kind of outreach. The second thing I would say is that if it's the case that states can't make those kinds of investments in outreach, then they should be using every aspect of their bully pulpits and the networks of people that they have relationships to, including community-based organizations, to get the word out about the fact that the census matters for the resources and representation we have and that it's safe and confidential to fill out. And then third, I would say for people who are just sort of wondering about what they can do, you can write to your elected officials at the state level, at the local level, to ask them, what are we doing to prepare ourselves for the 2030 census? What are we doing to invest in outreach? And then additionally, rather than simply waiting for a response, ask what you can do in the communities that you live in with a community-based organizations you're most familiar with to ensure that everybody in the place that you live knows those things about the census and is ready to take the 2030 census.
Phil, thank you for your research. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Kate.
That is Marquette University political scientist Philip Rocco. His new book is called Counting Like a State, How Intergovernmental Partnerships Shape the 2020 U.S. Census. And it lays out the importance of state and local cooperation in census taking and how local community involvement affects this once-in-a-decade effort.